and Carlisle Holby, and the series that is now in its fourth evening is C.S. Lewis as the first of the three examples of autobiography. And what I have been attempting to do in the three previous evenings has been to follow Lewis's description of his movement from atheism to Christianity, and along the way see not only that, but the theological insights, the religious ideas that he sort of explores and develops along the way. One of the characteristics of what I would term a good spiritual autobiography is that it is theological, not saying this happened to me, this happened to me, and this happened to me. But any autobiography that's worth its printing and binding is reflective. The person is looking at the meanings that he or she found in the life experiences and has something more of understanding to report. Now, I'm not going to go over all of the earlier lectures. Last evening, I was formally getting on into the matters of joy, as Luther, or as that's the kind of thing I do all the time, Lewis and Luther, as Lewis describes it. And again, the qualification that he was not using the term joy as happiness. He wasn't surprised by happiness, but by joy, which was a stab of feeling, very memorable one, but it had certain positive aspects, but then a sense of deep longing, of something that had been lost. Perhaps, I haven't really allowed as much time for discussion as I should have, but I thought about it myself that perhaps some of us have experienced something like that if we have come to a familiar place, our old home, and have had a sharp recollection of things that happened there. Perhaps there was much that was mixed in there. There was joy and there was also sorrow. Later on, as we are on our way back to Northfield, to our home, after our 3 weeks here and some traveling around, going out to Camino Island and across Canada, we plan to stop in my little old hometown in north central North Dakota. And I am not going in there with three handkerchiefs in each hand, but this will be the first time that I will go to the site of my home and the house in which I was born when that house will no longer be standing. And I think it's going to come sharply to me that here I was born, I lived for many years, my parents lived there, and there were not any deaths of members of the family, but it is these elements that go together. Lewis saw joy as something that came unbidden and at random times. Now, there is one aspect that I want to touch on briefly that ties in with his sense of joy. He was particularly sensitive to it when he was introduced quite by accident to Scandinavian mythology. Somehow there, he found this sense of not the fact that he had Scandinavian ancestors, but the old stories of those Scandinavian gods and goddesses and their experiences lifted him to a different plane of experience. Now, to enhance that, he got himself into Wagnerian music. bought records, listened to them. Now, Richard Wagner hasn't had the best name so far as any kind of Christian message is concerned, but that's irrelevant here. There's a grandeur there. There is a mystery there. There is a sense of something transcending our ordinary life. It was that that Lewis was sensitive to. And my particular usage of it here relates to his sense of holiness and awe-filled experience that is one of the operative forces in his religious experience. This was supplemented for him by some of his readings, and that's one of the things we note in this book, Surprised by Joy, that I think on average of once a page, on the average, sometimes more than one, but there is mention of a book that Lewis read. And that's only a very thin layer of the reading that he did. He was an avid reader and just in his home had access to a lot of books, would buy books on the stands, and that meant, as with your experience, you want to read something on the plane, or you're going off somewhere for some quiet rest, you look at what's available and you say, well, this doesn't look too bad. You take it and you may be disappointed or you may find some astonishingly good reading. There's a book by George MacDonald that Lewis picked up casually on a train station, and he said, he didn't know when he got that book just how hard it was going to hit him. MacDonald wrote some fairy tales, but they were imbued with a sense of Christian values and understandings. And Lewis had the highest regard for this, went finding more books. You will find in the bookstore here, no charge for the extra ad, some of MacDonald's writings that C.S. Lewis edited. He owed a tremendous debt to him. And here, too, the idea of holiness was there. When Lewis then came to one of the major stages in his spiritual development, it was, as he says, to recognize that God was God. Just that much. He had, as he says quite honestly, been an atheist. The atheist says that there is no God. But Lewis could not escape this God who had been pursuing him. The chapter titles are interesting. Some of you are chess players, and you know that as you progress and your opponent is getting you into a tight space, that you are checked. Now, you might be able to wiggle your way out, but if you can't do that, you come to a moment when you are checkmated. You might have a move or two or three left, but there's just no possible way of escaping. That's the kind of titles that Lewis uses later on. God has gotten into a point where he is forced to admit that God is God. He tells that at that moment, in his room at the college, he knelt and admitted that God was God. And then he adds, with some of that strange and wonderful and wild language of his, that at that moment he felt he was the most unwilling convert in all England. That doesn't sound very complimentary. It doesn't sound as though Lewis himself had any kind of response in it. We will talk about that elsewhere. But that God kept after him till that moment and pursued him even further, till it was not only saying, yes, God, you you frighten me, you awe me, and I must recognize that you exist. He tells also that he came to recognize that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. You're not looking here simply at a man who says, I have seen so much of the grandeur of God, I have seen so much of the wonders of the universe that I must acknowledge God. There are many other elements involved here. You realize that now I'm skimming the surface. There was scripture. There was previous experience. But as we will see a little later on, Lewis had set himself by a certain temperamental or personal quirk to resist all that. Now, last time I was into a further development, the baptized imagination. What happens when one becomes a believer, becomes a Christian, comes into the kingdom of God? For Lewis, it meant that there was a total, uncompromising yielding to God. But it was not in such a way that God fit him into a rigid, delimited human scheme. There is an image going back, I don't know how long, probably into classical times, of a Procrustean bed. Sometimes you see that term used just by itself. The background of that term is that away up in the mountain somewhere, you will not find this up on your trails here, there was a wicked giant living. And he had a castle up there, but he made out when the casual travelers came through that he was the world's finest host. And he would invite this wayward traveler in and treat him with such generosity and kindness that the person was taken in entirely. Everything went well until the giant escorted the guest to the bedroom. There was one bed there, and the host had one strange and horrible requirement. Anybody who slept in his bed had to fit. If you were too short, he stretched you until you fit, with disastrous results. If you were too tall, he lopped off the extra with the same kind of effect. That's a Procrustean bed that says, and spiritually is sometimes said, when you are a believer, you look like this, you act like this, you develop these and these only qualities and emotions. Well, I handpick out of a range of books that I use to get a range of witness, and I appreciate in Lewis that he had the good biblical sense to recognize that God accepted him into the kingdom as he was and baptized those unique gifts that God himself had given him. All of that reading and a whole lot of other elements in his intellectual and spiritual development had given him a fantastic imagination. It showed itself when he was a child and would write stories and illustrate them. There's a book for sale again. You will think that I am being retained as a bookstore's outside salesman. It is a fairly large book, different size, doesn't want to fit yourselves too well. Images of C.S. Lewis, something like that. And here there are reproductions of these childish stories, just to show how the child is father of the man. There is the prime minister of a country that Lewis created. And he is pictured here in full color. Very large and very fat frog, who is dressed in the formal clothing of prime minister of his time. There are other pictures like that. I see the child is father of the man, because if you know something about the Narnia series, you know that that has talking beavers, and the animal world is in constant interchange with the human world. There is more, of course, and I want to get at that later on. That's just one indication of the sort of, well, call it the spiritual ecology. I just thought that. That's a good one. God does not throw away the capacities that are in us. That when we come, we are to lose the verve that some of you have, lose the talents that all of you have, the distinctiveness that you have. You were baptized with a name. That name attaches to you and to all of your characteristics. It's not saying that these are not subtly changed so they can be used. But it's a good thing for the kingdom of God that the Apostle Peter, who came in with verve and gusto and the kind of immediate response that plunges him ahead of the rest of the disciples, as we heard in last Sunday's text, he's the one who wants to walk on the water to Jesus, and then he sinks, and then he is immediately shattered, cries out in dismay, "Lord, help." But there is that spontaneity in Peter that sends him out. He is unafraid. All of that is baptized in him. And that's an important thing to recognize in the kingdom. Put it in the nice, but not so vivid language of the New Testament, there are varieties of gifts. And we are the richer because of the gift of imagination that we find in Lewis. It is storytelling at its highest. And that's why so many children and adults have been intrigued by various writings. Children by the Narnia stories, adults perhaps by the stories. They are a kind of space fiction. We hear a lot about sci-fi, science fiction, and Lewis had read some of it, but he wasn't trying to imitate that. I want to point out just a little later how the worlds out there, accessible by a pretty primitive space travel, could be seen as evidence of God's power and grace. There are out in those worlds, again, talking animals, intelligent horses, religious horses, if you will, who worship God. And certain points are made here, and in the story of Paralandra, where he tries to retell the story that Ralph Gerke has been dealing with in Genesis. There is a pristine community there, a paradise. And Lewis wrestles with the question of what could have happened there. The future of that world depends on the new Eve in that context.
And now, while I have the light, let us live in the light and see if I can find the particular reference, and it's going to need good light because it's an old dittoed copy.
There is one statement here, I'm not going to read all these pages, but the temptation has come in the form of an earthling who perversely wants to spoil this new and pure work. Motives don't really count here. Why, if you see a lovely world, do you want it back? Well, darkness hates light. Evil hates goodness. And that's the picture you get portrayed here very concretely. Part of the pitch that's made by this evil person is that the lady, as the new Eve is turned here, is called, is not with it. She hasn't grown up yet. She's a child, she's naive. And here also there is a rule that the creator of that kingdom has come down with. And the tempter is saying, well, see, the God who created you wants you to know how to make decisions. He wants you to see that this decision could really be made this way, that it's ridiculous to follow it. So you will grow by disobeying. We have had people in our Western culture who have talked about the fall, not as a descent, but they've used the term and have talked about a fall upwards. The same perspective justifying the disobedience of humanity by saying, if it weren't for that, humanity would be less than human. That sounds pretty tricky, pretty sticky. But there is one point then which is really the crux of the answer of the woman, and it is the reverse of what you read in the Genesis account. The woman says, I begin to wonder whether you are so much older than I. Surely what you are saying is like fruit with no taste. How can I step out of his will, save into something that cannot be wished? Shall I start trying not to love him, or the king, that is her husband, or the beasts? It would be like trying to walk on water or swim through islands. Shall I try not to sleep, or to drink, or to laugh? I thought your words had a meaning, but now it seems they have not. To walk out of his will is to walk into nowhere. The man with whom I worked in my graduate studies, when I called this to attention in a seminar, astonished me. Not surprised, those of you here to hear my distinction will know why you say that. By A, saying that he had read this, and I thought he was so busy reading Karl Barth and all the other great theologians and translating and producing books by the dozen. He had read this, and B, saying, I think that is the finest thing that Lewis ever wrote. It is pure, vintage Lewis. Some time ago, I said, Lewis demonstrates the best of the philosophical art. He was a logician. He would not tolerate nonsense. And the lady picks that up. She says, I think all this talk about going up by disobeying is a lot of malarkey. It's nonsense. And that sort of pulls us up short, I think, when we hear people who really feel that whether it is the command of God in the garden, or the Decalogue, or the repetition of that compressed form in Deuteronomy, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, and all thy mind, that is, it's sort of a Procrustean bed made for all of us. There is superb, ultimate vision and wisdom. To walk out of the will of God is to go into nowhere. To live in the will of God, that's fulfillment. That's growth. That is not surrendering something. As I say, this is vintage Lewis. He makes the point not by formal theological statement. We would say he is a lay theologian, and he can write expertly in many fields on miracles, on the commentary on the Psalms, problems of personal grief, on prayer. But there's a subtlety and a complexity in his storytelling that is majestic. His imagination, baptized, brings to a focus all of these theological insights and serves as a follow-through on this spiritual autobiography contained in Surprised by Joy.
Let me give another example or two here.
Strange and yet marvelously effective work of the imagination called, and the title is strange, The Great Divorce. It is the divorce of heaven and hell. Not primarily a matter of human marital problems. I must say in preface here that there is some sacrifice of precise theological, fine honed statements in a work of the imagination. Narnia operates with images. Not say that you can find a place somewhere through the cabinet or the cupboard where you will find talking animals. But the point is made through the talking animals. I say that because it's possible that if we read The Great Divorce, we will say, there are some theological problems here. Let me just sketch through here. There is a sort of innocent bystander to whom we are introduced at a bus stop. We discover subsequently that this bus stop is in hell. And people are coming to the bus. This is the bus going to heaven. The British character of it is indicated in the fact that since the driver is not ready to load the bus, people are queuing up. If you ever go to Britain, I think even today, do not cut a line. They learned that during the war years when stockings were in short supply and foodstuffs, and while they were too ladylike and gentlemanly to do any physical violence to somebody that tried to get ahead, they always resented it. And when you waited at the bus line, you took your place very fastidiously. But in hell, it is different. And these spirits who are coming up to catch the bus are jostling one another, and there is a struggle constantly going on. The upshot of it is that many people say, oh, I didn't want to go anyway. These people here, it'd just be an awful ride, not like riding with a ninth grade school bus. I'm not going. But eventually some people do get in, and the observer along with them, and they make this travel through the sky. That's not so much more imaginative than Santa Claus with his sleigh. The bus goes from the Gray City. Along the way, this observer finds out some things about hell. It's a very large place because down there, people don't get along with their neighbors. But it's easy to get a new place. You don't have to worry about 15.5% interest rates on a 40-year mortgage and the possibility of that taking most of your income. You just sort of wish yourself a new place, but you go out to the borders. Only trouble is other people do the same thing. So you go farther and farther and farther to get away from those other evil people there. You're different, of course. Some of the people who are on the ride up to the heavenly sphere know that there was some mistake. The computer came up with the wrong information. They just can't get it straightened out. They don't belong down there. But as the bus goes along, it's going from that murky gray place. Now, there are no fires of hell here, which we might miss. This had been done in good Dante-esque fashion. Then we should have fires and tortures of varying kinds and degrees to make the punishment fit the crime, the punishment fit the crime, as Gilbert and Sullivan told us. But it's a great nuisance to follow. Every so often in Lewis's autobiography, too, he says he finds out that some of the writings of other atheists and non-believers, they're just dumb. Not exciting at all. Then he begins to find that the books that he is reading are written by Christians. He didn't say, I want some good Christian literature, but promptly again came on things by chance as he had George MacDonald. He said, this is good stuff. Probably we ought not be so apologetic and say, well, we don't produce much good Christian literature. We can't blame people if they read Playboy rather than the Lutheran Standard, after all. Or read the Bible. It's something that you have to do. But even the Wall Street Journal is more exciting. Well, that's hell. It's a dog. Wish yourself. And again, and here in the description of heaven, he gets very concrete. And I'm almost punning on that. Because they get there, and after a certain amount of pushing and shoving, the passengers get out. And the vision is beautiful, except that it is frightfully bright. Too bright. And they didn't bring along their dark glasses, and they fussing about that as they fuss about most everything. Step out on the grass. They are shades, but still, their feet are cut. The grass is beautiful, soft grass, but for them, it is like walking on spears upturned. They are unreal. Meanwhile, around them, there are people who are walking around here, enjoying it. There is a fine mist. For the people up there, it's the kind of mist that you Tacoma, Seattle people glory in and tell us is liquid sunshine, and you don't need to carry an umbrella. It's wonderful. Through the shades, this is like hailstones or pelting buckshot, and it goes through them. I get a picture here, improving on Lewis. That they come out of that looking like Dick Tracy. In the old scenes, remember when he had been fighting with the bad men and he comes out looking like a piece of Swiss cheese in a black suit full of holes? What's Lewis saying? This is the real world. It is a solid world. We got the image and probably isn't too harmful going to heaven and sitting up there on cloud nine, playing harps, kind of insubstantial, we don't fall through. Further, there are people who come to meet the shades, and these are the ones who are in glory. And Lewis makes continual points that they are there not by their works, but by the grace of God. They have been forgiven. There are murderers. There are people who have been vicious mates. They have repented, and here they are. You have some confrontations. I'm not too precise. I didn't review all of this, but it is as if the victim of a murder is in the gray land, and he confronts his murderer and says, "You killed me. What are you doing here?" Things are topsy-turvy. There are spouses. And the one from the gray lands says, "You were so miserable a spouse to me, and you caused so much trouble. I tolerated you all the time. I was good to you. Now you are here, and I'm down in the gray land." The spirits of the heavenly realm say, "But you can stay here." And here, of course, is one of the probably dubious theological statements. There is another chance And it would appear that if they go back once, they might come back again. And we'd say, that's not in the Bible. Lewis isn't trying to say that, but he is trying to say that salvation is through grace, through forgiveness. I had a deacon that I had to call on one occasion, Sunday morning, because I came up with laryngitis. He was a very biblically based person, praying man, did a marvelous job on short notice. I think it was then that he said he had read somewhere and remembered that the Apostle Paul progressed through three stages. Maybe I can't recall them now, but one was he was a sinner, and the other was that he was a great sinner, and then when he came to his final confession, I am the greatest of all sinners. Grace sufficient. That's what Lewis is saying here, concretely. And probably he captivated some people, at least, who picked up that book, thinking, always interested in divorce, and that must be what it's about. And then they read on, and they find that they have been caught up in a web of religious statements, forgiveness, and the like. Now, I'm stuck as usual, coming to near the end of the time here. Don't get too uneasy. I will excuse you for a certain amount of uneasiness. I have gone some other sessions and sat in these chairs, and I realize that while they look comfortable, there's a certain point at which you get tired of going back and squatting, wondering if something is wrong with you or what. But the announced topic tonight was C.S. Lewis, Problems of Loneliness. And I do expect to go on tomorrow with the second book, the book by Ayako Miura, contemporary Japanese woman poet, writer of fiction. The wind is howling. So I'd better get on a bit more. I can always say, well, there are new people here. This will be tomorrow evening. I better review a little bit of what I finished up with, and some things I didn't finish at all. What about this matter of loneliness? There is not a great deal here. There is some excitement of our sympathy for the young Lewis. His mother died when he was very young. He had prayed that she be healed from her disease. She was not. She died. He had then, and for the rest of his life, an older brother, a father who died some years before Lewis did, but a motherless home. And his father did not have the kind of warmth and sympathy that could continue the loving motherly care. So he was lonely. His older brother went off to school. They were both to be packed off ultimately to boarding school. He spent a great deal of time at home with the books. And some of that contributes to his sort of isolation. When he was dragged out into company then and later, as he tended to be, he tried to follow along the adult model and talk. He says of himself that he was priggish. He spoke on a level that a young child wasn't supposed to. Well, he had read more than most of the adults in the crowd, and they looked on him with a certain amount of contempt. Showing off, our young man, they should have left you in the nursery. He goes off to school, and there's something about the English boarding schools that is not the warmest in terms of social interchange. I mentioned there's a picture in that book, images of the kind of barracks-like room in which Lewis and other little boys were put. There aren't any curtains in it. Don't complain about your bed. You might get sent to a place like that. The steel frames and, I'm sure, thin mattresses. No privacy. And in that context also, there were certain expectations. All the boys who were here were supposed to want to spend a lot of time playing games. Well, Lewis had never learned. He uses what might be a rather feeble excuse, but it shows his sense of not me. He said he didn't have a
proper joint in his thumb so he couldn't hold the cricket bat, whatever they call it, properly, or throw a ball properly. He was something of an outcast. And his intellectual interest and his love for reading set him apart. Oh, we have names for people like that still. They're sort of boring people, even around a college. They're grinds. You know, come on, let's just knock it off for a few hours. Let's go down and play some basketball, or let's ride bicycles downtown, or how about you're taking the car, and we'll just drive up and down Division Street for a few hours. No, I got to study. Well, go on, study. Later on, Lewis comments on this in one particular place where it wasn't only his fellow students, but some of the teachers also, who gave Lewis a difficult time. It was a place where you were supposed to belong to a certain subgroup. And apparently some teacher was vicious enough not to tell Lewis where he should go. They were assigned. And so Lewis scuttled around trying to find where he went, and it ended up that he was supposed to have been with a certain group and didn't know it. And then he got a beating because he hadn't been there. This too drives him into a solitariness. But I don't want again to give the impression that he took from this that it was all somebody else's fault. There's a notable statement, and something strange happened in my book today. I had the particular passage marked, and I was looking for a marker to put in, and I lost it, and it's disappeared. It isn't in the book any longer. And I wanted it because Lewis says in there very precisely, he said, there was one thing that I did not like, and that was being interfered with. And I've already told you about God pursuing him. That was God's interference. I did copy down one similar statement that I found. And again, it's some of that marvelous language. Page 191 says here, Lewis, God is very unscrupulous. He invades. He doesn't respect one's privacy. I suppose the British would say privacy. Along with that also, there is, of course, the threat which Lewis began to feel more and more active. And that was, well, if he became a Christian, he should start going to church again. Well, he had been going to formal prayer services, that sort of thing. I'm watching the times when we go to vespers. But he was just there, something that you should do. And now we do have light here, and I think I can find it quickly. Page 234, and this is the kind of sheet there should be in there. Though I like clergymen as I like bears, I'm not sure I like that. Well, of course, some people like bears better than they like clergymen. I had a little wish to be in the church as in the zoo. It was, to begin with, a kind of collective, a wearisome get-together affair. I couldn't yet see how a concern of that sort should have anything to do with one's spiritual life. So he's sort of making his own terms. If he's going to be a Christian, he's going to be it privately. I don't need the church. I worship God there when I see the grandeur. Bunch of hypocrites in the church anyway. We haven't got enough preachers, and I wouldn't have been one of them anyway, like the one who met a prospective member of the congregation and said, well, Reverend, I've thought of coming to your church, but I know there are a lot of hypocrites there. And the pastor said, that don't let that stop you. There's always room for one more. How's the end? It's the bottom line, as we saw. Lewis accepts the intrusion of God, the unscrupulosity of God, who will not let him go, O love that wilt not let me go. And when he becomes a Christian, he does engage in that miserable collection. He didn't expect that it should be, perfect. But his place as a believer was there. And he found not an exclusive association with good, proper Christians, very varied group, but his own faith kept riding through. He had good friends who were, some kind of pan something or other. They could talk and they could argue, and each of them stayed in their same position. Well, that's the story. It doesn't quite finish up with Lewis's entire life. Really, the autobiography cuts off without saying much about all the Christian witness that he did. Now, in my great generosity, instead of half an hour for discussion, I have left about 3.5 minutes. But I have to sleep at night with a little better conscience. Are there comments or questions? Remembering I'll be around here for a while, you can pick at me outside of school, too. Some things that you picked up particularly, or questions you want to raise?
I was curious as to how much of his writing was done prior to the time he became a Christian that's really noteworthy, or what proportion of it was done afterwards.
I don't have a copy here of his writings. He wasn't writing in the Christian sphere. He was doing academic writing. That was sort of a parallel, and he kept on with that too. It's all the more amazing because, as I said early on, his writing in the realm of English literature, he was a specialist in the medieval era, he was just very specialized, still in print. Allegory of Love, the Four Loves, and some of the, then he has one that we don't see very commonly, but it's the scholar's kind of history of a certain period of English literature. It's a standard. But there's just a constant flow, and when you realize that he wasn't making a mint on royalties on his books ever. He did a certain amount of radio talking. Some of that transformed into books. And just a wealth of other material. But he was reading students' papers and having students come in for tutorials for a rather, not scanty, but a limited living. So I just marvel at the productivity, and look over in the bookstore again. That's the third ad they've had tonight. And you'll see a pretty good array of them. I can't, since I'm not representing the bookstore, recommend that our students do. You'll see them standing in the back. I think we have students who have read quite a few books back there, half an hour at a time without paying. If you must, look through them and read a few pages. Just don't dog ear where you left off. Something else. I think there's time for another minute. Yes.
What happened to Lewis then if he joined the church? Did he take up closer relationships, say, with a parish or with a group of intellectuals like himself, Christian people? Was there any real change then?
There are several elements here that are clues. I can't give you a tidy answer. He was buried in a small church just outside of Oxford that was sort of his home church. That says something, I think. And he and his brother and other close friends did a lot of hiking throughout England. That was the way they spent their time on vacation. It was cheap. And it was not just walking down a nice, hard road. When they came to a little country church, as you would throughout England on those roads, they would go in there, and they'd be open, free to the passerby, very reverently. Someone would step up to the lectern and read a passage of scripture before they went on. I like that. It was not for show, and they shared, I think, that same sense that here was an opportunity to worship, break their I don't, again, have it in this particular set of notes. Later in life, he married, and that's another story. We put a petition up, and I can tell it to you tomorrow, but I haven't got time now. And his wife, who had cancer when he married her, and had a remission, and then had a renewal of the cancer, died after only a very short married life. But it was a genuine thing, in spite of some peculiar elements, almost a convenience marriage for her. The epitaph that he wrote for Joy Davidman Lewis is just a marvelous, succinct statement of the Christian faith. And it took him a couple of years to sort of shape it, just a few lines. But it has, you know, here lie the ashes, Joy had been cremated. And then it goes on with, she has laid off the garments of this life to resume them on her Easter day. Simple, poignant confession of faith in the resurrection. And he is, in spite of what I've said, very conservative and a very evangelical Christian. And that probably at that time in England made it a little difficult to find a congregation with a lot of zealous people of that same stripe. Thank you. Tomorrow we'll go on with...